For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury. This station is proud to present StoryCorps Athens, a collection of interviews as part of a national initiative to record and preserve the stories of everyday people. These stories were recorded by our friends and neighbors in Athens in the StoryCorps mobile booth during the fall of 2018. Mother's Day is this weekend, and this is the perfect time to stop and reminisce about times with our mothers and to thank them for all they've done for us. In this StoryCorps special, each of our guests does just that. You'll hear conversations between mothers and their children, friends reminiscing about mothers who have passed, and even a couple of grateful husbands whose wives are wonderful mothers in their own right. Our first story comes from Ernest Thompson and his wife of 51 years, Odella. Ernest grew up in Charleston, South Carolina with his mother and his sister, Ernestine. Even though his family was poor, Ernest says that his mother always managed to provide. And in this story, he recounts the lengths that she would go to in order to ensure Ernest and his sister grew up happy.
Mom always seemed to be concerned about food, but I don't ever remember being hungry. And I don't know where our income came from at that time. I have no idea. Now, Mom, later on, I remember her working in kitchens for white people, right, as maids and whatnot. But at that time, she could not have been working because we weren't left with babysitters, you know.
Okay.
She was taking care of us. And I can remember she was refusing welfare. So I don't know how we were eating. But we always seemed to have had something to eat, although Mom was always complaining that there wasn't enough. I remember eating grits and eggs, and I remember that I didn't like the grits. So to get around that, Mom would fry the egg, not fully cooked, soft, mix it up in the grits. And when I liked the egg, so when she mixed eggs up in the grits, it got me to eat the grits. So now, here I am, 83 years old, and I still mix my eggs up into my grits to eat, right?
Tell us about your neighborhood.
75 Columbus Street in Charleston.
Okay.
That was a very interesting neighborhood because that was an integrated neighborhood back then. And today, people wouldn't think of a neighborhood in Charleston in that time being integrated, but it was. I was kind of quiet, but Ernestine was very social, and she attracted all these kids. And two of her friends, so the white girl next door, Alice, used to play with Ernestine, and the little Greek girl down on the corner, Tula, used to play with Ernestine. But also, I got a little education from Tula. You know, what happened was Tula's mom became pregnant. Now, black families were very tight about sexual stuff. They didn't talk about it, you know. So I must have been five or so, and Tula's mom gets pregnant. So I'm asking my mom about it because I noticed Tula's mom's stomach getting larger, right? And Mom says, well, she has a tumor.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, wait, what they going to... She said, well, they'll take it out. And I said, okay, well, one day, I sure enough, I saw the doctor come up to Tula's house, jumped out of his car with the little bag. And so I go, I'm excited. I run, and I said, Mama, the doctor went to Tula's house. And she says, well, he's going to take the tumor out of Tula's mom's stomach. So, okay. The next day, Tula comes to play, right? And I go, I said, Tula, the doctor took the tumor out your mama's stomach. Tula says, there was no tumor in my mom's stomach. There was a baby in my mom's. I said, this is the most remarkable thing I ever heard, right? So I run in the house to tell my mom, right? And as fate would necessarily have it, she has company at the time. Some of her church people are sitting there. And I says, Mama, guess what Tula said, right? I said, what did Tula say? Tula said her mom doesn't have a, had no tomb in her stomach. Her mama had a baby in her stomach. And there's just a gas goes up in the room.
Your mom really must have been a very remarkable person.
She was strong, no doubt about it. She believed one of the things she told me at a very young age, anything anybody can do, you can do. Years later, when I learned what Jackie Robinson could do with a baseball, I decided that wasn't exactly true, but that attitude stuck with me.
When Heather Christofferson married Kathy Castellion's youngest son, she was amazed by Kathy's resilience through difficult circumstances. In this story, Kathy tells Heather what it was like raising her five children as a single mom and the sacrifices she made to give them the best childhood possible.
I always have been amazed that you had five kids and you raised them practically solo, went to school and were able to accomplish that. Like, I'm in awe of that. I admire that so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was an interesting time in my life, to put it kindly.
Right. What was the happiest moment of your life?
There were so many, many wonderful times.
Give me a couple.
Well, I was so thrilled when I got to go to Wrigley Field and watch the Cubs play baseball. To me, that was like a dream come true. I got a lovely cruise. I went with your husband and you. I went to Jamaica. I went to Jamaica twice. And I had a gentleman at one time when I was single that took me on a date to Hawaii.
Oh,
so I have had some pretty cool things that I have done. Yes.
Yes. And the opposite of that, what was your saddest moment?
My saddest moment was not being able to give my children what they truly deserved. I raised them alone with no money and moving from rental house to rental house, and they deserved better. They deserved tennis lessons and golf lessons, and they deserved music lessons. I did read to them and loved them and played with them, but I wish that I could have done more. When I was a young mother, women were second-class citizens. You could not work at McDonald's. You couldn't get your tubes tied without your husband's permission. You were totally a second-class citizen, and you didn't do anything without that man's permission, and that was very hard when you're a bright woman trying to get ahead in life.
What are you proudest of?
My sense of responsibility, my courage to go on and raise those kids. I'm proud of the fact that I hung in there, got the job done. They all got fed, and they're all happy, healthy people now, and they're all very good to their mother.
You were alone and raising, five kids. Did you have friends you could depend on or other family? Like, I don't know if your parents lived nearby. I know you have a sister and a brother. Like, did you have a support system?
Actually, I really didn't. For the most part, it was just, it took up all my time, five kids. You've met them.
Yes, I have met them.
Yes.
Yeah. Was that lonely? Even though you had five kids, was it lonely to not have that family?
No.
Okay.
I wasn't resentful either. I enjoyed those kids. We had fun. We'd play ball out in the yard, and we would play Scrabble when it got cold out, and we watched baseball on the TV, and we didn't have any money, but we had each other. And when we watched Little House on the Prairie, I would make beans and brown bread, and they thought they were really dining high class, but it was very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. But, they enjoyed that, and I did their school functions, and then there was a neighbor lady that was kind to me, and we got by. We had each other.
Yeah. If this was our very last conversation, is there anything you'd want to say to me?
Oh, Heather, I'm so proud of the way you're raising those children and the way you love my son. Don't let go of that. Don't let go of that wonderful love you have for those kids and your husband, and hug them and hold them and keep reading to them, and make sure that they grow up to be the kindest, most wonderful people they can be.
I definitely will. I have so appreciated you being a mother figure to me when I didn't have that. So I'm really glad you've been a part of our lives and my life.
Well, I have enjoyed your love and friendship, and you're like a daughter to me. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And those kids, I just adore those children. And it has been so nice to have you only a mile away.
Oh,
and we've had some wonderful times together.
Yes, we have. I look forward to many more.
Kai Hernandez-Gamble was born with a rare condition called Perthes disease, which prevented proper growth in his legs and hips. In this story, Kai tells his mother, Jill Gamble, about overcoming Perthes and shocks his mom with a surprise confession. Here's Kai and Jill.
Kai, do you want to introduce yourself? How would you describe yourself?
Funny, smart, and sporty.
And sporty? What kind of sports do you play?
Baseball, swimming, and basketball.
What has been the happiest moment of your life so far?
Probably getting Rosie.
Getting Rosie? And who's Rosie?
My puppy dog.
Why was that the happiest day?
Because she was so cute and she's so cute.
Do you love Rosie?
Yes.
What are you the proudest of in your life?
Getting out of a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm. Why were you in a wheelchair?
Because I was diagnosed with a disease called leg calf Perthes disease, and that's when your femur stops receiving blood and bone dies, so I had to have surgery. And I had to get in a wheelchair, and I had two casts, so it was kind of hard.
How old were you when you were diagnosed?
6.
And what was happening before that?
I was playing basketball.
Mm-hmm. You were also playing baseball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then what started to happen that we noticed something was wrong?
I was limping.
And how did you feel when you were diagnosed?
I was confused because I didn't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about a couple of the casts that you had?
They kind of looked, it was like a V, kind of. They were two wooden sticks going across, so I couldn't move them together.
What did that make it hard to do?
Getting indoors.
Right, it was too wide to get through doorways. So you had to stay at home all the time. You couldn't go to school. Do you remember what happened with our, what was hard at our house?
I couldn't get through the door, so you had to move your bed into the living room.
Mm-hmm. So what are you proudest of in your battle with Perthes disease?
Getting a reputation at my school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Everybody knows me.
Is that because you were the kid in the wheelchair?
Yeah.
Oh. So you think the disease made you popular?
Kind of.
Well, I guess that's a good thing. So if this were to be our very last conversation, Kai Kai, is there anything you'd want to say to me?
I love you. You probably already know this, but you remember that frisbee that you had?
Oh, the frisbee from Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you said I could throw it, and I did, and then it got stuck in a bush, and I didn't find it.
Is that where it went?
Yeah.
Oh, and you're just now telling me this?
Yep.
Oh, no. Do you know what I would tell you if this was our last conversation?
What?
That I love you, and I'm so proud of you, and I'm so grateful to have you in my life, because you're so gentle and caring. You do a great job. Even though you're only 10 years old, you take care of me sometimes. And that I hope you will always keep your sense of fun.
For many people, mothers are an inspiration of strength. And this strength is definitely apparent in the next conversation. Dr. Patricia Priest talks with her spirited mother, Mildred Jean Joyner, about what life was like raising children after her husband passed away, and what it was like working in a field dominated by men.
Mom, you were born in 1932, seems impossible, and you grew up in the tiny crossroads of Epsom, North Carolina, near Henderson. And so that's a farming community growing tobacco, right?
That's right. I had a wonderful childhood. My mother and I read every book practically available at the Henderson Library. And every Saturday was noted for going up there and picking up 10 new books that I was going to read the coming week.
Well, I thought of it as being rather difficult childhood, but you said, oh, no, oh, it was wonderful.
Well, I just loved being a child and imagining being out, lying out in the grass and thinking, what is that cloud? What does that remind me of? Something I've read about or what?
Well, I think of you working in the tobacco rows.
Oh, yes. And as I got older than the childhood, we had tobacco and cotton, and it was hard, dirty work. And I vowed on some of those long cotton rows that I was going to go to college and learn how to do something else.
Well, you know, I want to skip ahead a bit. So after Dad died, you had a big decision with your four kids. One was in college at UMass, and we lived in Massachusetts at the time, where to take us, where to live.
Well, I came back to Raleigh because there were a lot of cultural advantages for the four of you. And I had graduated from Meredith, so I was aware of what was going on in that area. And that was proven to be such a wonderful choice. But I knew I need to back up and say that when we left Massachusetts, you and Daryl were flying back, and the two older girls were coming back with me back to bring the car. And I walked up to the counter. She says, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Raleigh, North Carolina." And I said, "The end of the world." She said, "Oh, or the beginning." And I just thought that was so prophetic, too, because it certainly was a new beginning, mm-hmm. and we did the best we could.
Well, that was a very hard time for all of us for a long time, but you ended up working for three U.S. senators in turn.
That's right.
Just doing amazing work. So you were such an advocate for other people. You were Senate staff, U.S. Senate, and you worked in Veterans Affairs.
And Armed Services.
Right. And you fought for those
people. I did. And sometimes, I must say, the military would try to give me a hard time and say, so-and-so can't be done. And I said, oh, I know it can be done. And, of course, knowing the other side of the military and what they could and could not do.
Under Senator Morgan, female staffers could not travel by themselves throughout the state.
No, but remember, this is 1974, and women didn't do things like that. So I went, when he was down in our office one day, I said that I would really like to talk to you about this, that we have to go with another woman or with a man when we go traveling through the state. And I said, I've been, ever since my husband died, I've been everywhere. By myself, and I can change a tire, which I couldn't do very well, but anyway, and so that's quite all right. He said, well, we'll give it a try. We'll see how it works out. And along that same line, I'll have to tell you, the ERA amendment came up, and he was being advised by all the men staffers, and I was in D.C. that day to work in that office for another event, and I said, well, Senator, what do you think? You've got two brilliant daughters. Do you not want them to have equal rights with the men? So next thing I knew, now he didn't vote for it, but he abstained, and that was a big, big, big thing to get him to change his mind.
Well, you have fought the good fight, and I'm so proud of you. I try to live up to even a part of that legacy you've done for the people in your state and for your children.
But when you get old, you look back over things and you can't relate sometimes that you were so obstinate or determined.
That's what you don't like about me.
But I need to say, to be sure, before we finish our little conversation, that I'm proudest. I've had some wonderful jobs, and I've done some, with the help of my senators, I've done some great things. But I am the proudest of my four children and all they have accomplished in this life. And I know if my husband's sitting up there on some cloud, he's saying, well done, Mildred Jean.
On Mother's Day, appreciation is not solely the responsibility of children. Husbands often show their appreciation and admire the balancing act of motherhood and life's challenges. In the next conversation, Raymond Akridge Sr. and his son, Ray Akridge Jr., pay homage to their wives and praise them for all the different roles they play every day.
It would be hard to start anything without reflecting on my wife. Her name is Mavis. We've been married 54 years. And some years ago, I felt the need to try to surmise what this person has meant to me on this journey of 54 years. Our wedding day on this day, who could have dreamed of Ray and our wonderful family, of all the sacrifices and of the struggles to understand life and where we wanted it to go. We took the long route in coming to this far-off day, but in taking the long route, we've seen so many more flowers. I don't know how much I've learned by the way I have approached life. Sometimes I think I've learned a lot, and sometimes almost nothing. However, I do know that she has always been by my side, and that she has always supported what I cared for and wanted to do in life. And Ray, I think you can understand from knowing your mother that you see in that write-up everything that I do.
Absolutely. And it's beautifully said. And as a son with a mother like that, she's always been the silent force that's held everything together for us. Not that vocal in nature, which is fine, but definitely a presence that had to be there and needed to be there through the times to make everything right in its own way for our family. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Being from Ray City, Georgia, which is a farming community, reminds me of a saying that a good plower is someone that can plow a long, long, straight row. And that's your mother. She's not flashy, but she plows a long, straight row of steadiness. She's a rock for us all.
Absolutely.
You know, all we ever wanted from you was to be the kind of person that treated people right and loved other people. Hallelujah, you were able to add to that some skills we don't know where you got, and added to that, you know, a successful life for yourself that brings us great joy. So,
well, it's been one of those journeys that's been incredible for me as well, not only personally, because without you and Mom, as I said before, those things would not be possible to initiate those potential abilities. And also, without my direct family, would those be possible to initiate and sustain those, primarily being my wife, Stacy, of 25 years, who I love more than life itself, and my two wonderful daughters.
You met a beautiful human being in Stacy. Her heart is as big as gold, and Stacy has brought to my life, and I think to our entire family, balance, a little less emphasis on goal achievement and a little more emphasis on let's lay back and enjoy this journey a little bit.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And then the love from Mom and my wife, Stacy, and Bailey and Chloe gives you the strength to do the things sometimes in life, as we discussed a minute ago, that you don't think you can achieve and you can
right.
do. But through that love, stranger things have happened.
So. That's right.
Our next two stories come from women who had very different experiences during the Second World War, and their daughters who want to know more about how these experiences shaped their mothers. Sam Kuntz was born in Latvia in 1940, just before World War II began. In this conversation, she tells her daughter, Ruta Abelins, not only about her experience escaping Latvia and her eventual move to the United States, but she also talks about her own mother and the brave Latvian women who nurtured the displaced children.
Where were you born?
Riga, Latvia, 1940.
So you're a little child during World War II. Do you have a first memory of, like, when the war affected you or your family?
Yes. I do remember my father not coming home. And at that time, I did not know why. But my father was picked up by, actually by Germans, and taken away. And I remember the bombs falling. I remember as a child that my mother, we had to have no lights in the house because we were living close to downtown Riga. And I remember my mother carrying my little sister, and we would be downtown in a bigger complex where we're in a basement. And I remember them singing and trying to quiet us children down.
So you're in Riga and your dad is gone.
Yes.
And it sounded like You just told me you were in a bomb shelter, probably.
Yes, we were in a bomb shelter 3-4 times that I remember. So I remember with my mother, whatever money she had at home, and we buried some things in the backyard on the left side by a fence, and I remember helping her, having it in a cloth and whatever, thinking that we're going to be coming back. And my mother took my sister in a buggy. She put a few pictures underneath the mattress there and whatever money we had, and we traveled to a train station.
Did Omite know where you were going to go?
No. We had to leave, otherwise we'd become under communist rule.
I think I've heard you tell me before that you were in Czechoslovakia.
Well, we had somebody pick us up in a big truck, just women and children, and these were all Latvians, and they put us in Cheskin Kalns, which is Cheskin Hill. I don't know what we did with food, because we were just children and women. We finally got to a free zone in Germany, and we were put in a displaced persons camp in the French zone. But the miracle of the whole thing was that we got transferred to an American zone in Würzburg, Germany. The camp was huge, a lot of Latvians, and very clean. They had American movies, Johnny Weissmuller, and all the movies so we could learn a language besides German.
Is this why you had a fascination with Tarzan?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now it's coming full circle for me.
But the nicest thing about the camp, American soldiers, they came and saw us, and they came back. Hershey bars, gum. They adored us, and we just loved them. And this is why my parents were so happy when we were told that we are coming to America. Most of our friends went to Australia, to New Zealand, some to New York, some to Mississippi. We had this, actually, a feeling of safeness in that camp, and having to wait 3.5 years to be processed to go. And so we came to America.
So I'm going to shift gears here.
All right.
Because I want to ask you about moving in with me. When you moved in with me. Now, I invited you to live with me here in Georgia because I felt like you were struggling in Milwaukee.
Well, yes. When I came here, I mean, I had had my surgeries. The nicest thing about the whole thing is that you didn't treat me like an invalid. You pushed me in a very nice way, and I grew by it. You always patted me on the back and, great job, Mom. And you introduced me to dancing.
I've really enjoyed listening
to
you
today. I just wanted to tell everybody what a great daughter you are. You are so impressive. If everybody could have a daughter like you. Oh.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Sam.
You're the best.
Rosa Paul Hill Green decided to serve the United States during World War II through the WAVES program, a volunteer initiative in which women worked as part of the U.S. Naval Reserve. In this conversation, Rosa talks to her daughter, Emily Green, about what it was like serving under the WAVES and the historic projects she helped complete.
Little Rosa, one of the things that you have shared with me throughout the years is your memories of your experience during World War II as a member of the WAVES. Can you tell me a little bit about how you made the decision to enlist in the WAVES?
Well, I made the decision because our country was at war, and our country at that time was united in every way. Every American had some interest in World War II, and I wanted to do my part, so I volunteered.
And that was in 1944, and you were 20 years old?
Right.
And the WAVES was established by Roosevelt, right, during World War II?
Yes. I had to go to Atlanta to be sworn in, and the person who was at the head of the office was a WAVE ensign. And before I signed, she was very impressive to be sure that I understood what I was doing, that I was no longer a free citizen. I was a citizen of the Navy, and I was agreeing to serve for the duration of the war and 6 months after. When I went into boot camp, it took me only half a day to know that I was not going to get any special treatment because I was a woman. Many times I was accused of being an idiot. Somebody in power would say, "Seaman, can't you read?" when I went to the wrong office or did the wrong thing.
You're such a sensitive person. Did it hurt your feelings? Did you cry, or did you just buck up
I cried and shook the whole time I was in boot camp.
And then from Iowa, what was your assignment?
My assignment was Washington, D.C. I was to go to the Department of Ordnance.
What specifically did you do?
I typed all day long. If there was any extra duty that was needed in that office, the WAVES did it.
Did you have any idea what it was that you were typing?
I did find out after I got out of the WAVES, one of the top secret forms that I had typed was ordnance that was going to New Mexico for the Manhattan Project.
Wow. It took courage to do what you did. You were a young woman from a very small town who had hardly been outside of the state of Georgia.
Yeah.
Making a commitment like that, not knowing how long you were going to be away, where you were going to be, what you were going to be doing. That took great courage and great patriotism.
This is still a great country, but we seem to be heading in the wrong direction.
You think there's hope?
Yes, I have to think there's hope. You couldn't go on if you didn't think there was hope.
In this conversation, Dr. Tanya Kofer tells close friend Dr. Catherine Losey stories about her late mother, Puerto Rican poet and former UGA faculty member Judith Ortiz Kofer. They reminisce about what a wonderful poet and storyteller Kofer was and discuss how her Puerto Rican heritage shaped her writing and her approach to motherhood.
How did she share her Puerto Rican roots with you?
She shared a lot of that history through her writing with me. I think that she helped me connect with my Puerto Rican heritage by sending me to my grandmother's house every summer when I was growing up, and the fact that my grandmother, my mother's mother, helped raise me because my mother was still in school when I was born. Her mother was her tie to the island. Her mother was that connection, that umbilical cord to that part of her heritage, and she shared it with me by having my grandmother be such an important and big part of my early life. You know, a lot of the stories that she told me about growing up were also things that she wrote about and that she shared with the world. So stories, tales told under the mangrove tree, and about my mother's grandmother, who was also a very powerful woman.
I just love this story, so I would like for you to tell it about the time when you were spending the summer with your grandmother, and you had, before you left, started reading Alice in Wonderland with your mother.
Oh, yes. Well, my mother started reading it to me, and I was not going to let her stop. I insisted that she tape herself. So, she would tape herself reading the rest of Alice in Wonderland for me. And in Puerto Rico, I would wait for those tapes to come in the mail, and I would lie on the bed in Puerto Rico at night And I would listen to my mother's voice reading to me that magical story. And she did that out of love for me. That must have been hours, you know, in retrospect, it must have been hours she spent recording herself. She planted books for me to read. I don't know if she ever did that with you, but, you know, whenever I would come home, if I was away at college or if I was working and I came home for summer break or winter break and in my old room, you know, I would find next to the bed, there would just be a book or two, you know, but very carefully selected. I remember as a teenager, she would put, it wasn't just books. I mean, there were art, Monet and Klimt. She would put pictures, postcard pictures on the refrigerator. And, so that every time I went to the refrigerator, I would look at these things and learn about art.
Did. And she used you to make some of that art. She wrote about you in a lot of poems and essays. And
yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about that, your favorite one perhaps, and what that meant to you?
You know, I think that when it came to writing about me, I believe that the first one that really just made me catch my breath in how profoundly she understood what was going on in with me emotionally was Who Will Not Be Vanquished. And it's a beautiful story written for me when I was 15. And it was this abrupt end to the innocence of childhood. I was so angry. You know, I didn't share anything with her, honestly. It was one of those teenage moments where I was I was just angry and I didn't talk to her, but she seemed to know what was in my head. You know, she knew I felt betrayed. I felt anger. I knew that she was documenting love and, you know, how profoundly she thought about me and my future and all the things that were going to challenge me growing up. But I think that Who Will Not Be Vanquished was one of those that just sort of... it made me cry, you know, because I felt so understood by her. And a lot of times that's when I understood her.
She gave you art, you know, she shared her love of that with you. Could you talk a little bit about your project to be the photographer for the book cover and what that was like?
She was so incredibly supportive. She was incredibly proud of me and my choice to be a mathematician and to be a scientist, and that was my primary calling in terms of my work life. But, you know, I have always loved to be creative, and you know, later on in life, and I partly probably because of the beauty of the Chicago Botanic Gardens, I picked up photography, and you know, with real photography, DSLR photography, and lots of nature photography. She was my biggest fan and my biggest encourager, and you know, she wanted me to do the cover of her book, and you know, she made that happen, and it was. It's just an act of love and of support. Is there anything that you want to tell me about my mom?
Well, I mean, you were her favorite subject. You know she loved you, but she loved you so much and just loved to share things about you and was just so proud.
I'm honored to know that. I mean, I think I knew it, but it's nice to hear from somebody else. And,
well, you would expect her to tell you that.
Right.
You know, I love you. But yeah, she really did. Something she loved to talk about with others. So.
Yeah. Well, she was a favorite subject of mine, too. I like to talk about my mom.
Brittany Barnes had a lot of questions for her father, Remy Barnes, about her grandmother when they entered the StoryCorps mobile booth in the fall of 2018. In light of the Me Too movement, Brittany wanted to hear about her grandmother's own feminist ideologies and what her father thinks his mother would have to say about modern-day protests. Here's Brittany and Remy.
Do you think that she was happy with her life?
No. I think she was frustrated. Mm. I think she was happy in her marriage. She's happy to be a mother.
Yeah.
And because that's what you're supposed to do at that time.
Right,
And she worked hard at that.
Right.
But I think she was very frustrated. Your grandmother was an exceptionally accomplished woman who went to Hendricks College. She, at the time, was an assistant to Helen Keller. She was the first woman ever to debate for the United States debating team, and in fact was the lead debater and beat the Oxford team in a showdown in the United States.
I think that sometimes we fail to talk about is that, you know, your mom was left to take care of you. While her husband was away at war, she was the one with you. And I kind of want to talk about her strength. Did she have a career, Dad?
Well, she didn't. She did a lot of work with the blind. Later on, she became a ghostwriter, an editor. In fact, she wrote and edited later on some of the propaganda for Chiang Kai-shek when he was leaving China, going into Taiwan. And when we moved to California, we moved to a small town, and there was a large Japanese community at that place. We adopted a young girl whose family had disappeared in a fire and had gone through the horrendous area of having been taken from their farm and sent to Arizona like they were traitors, and everything they lost, they built up, they were American citizens. Anyway, she was involved with the writing of the book, which is the pivotal, the study of that whole betrayal. She helped edit that whole process. And what happened was the lady writing it, she was from Stanford University, came and interviewed your grandmother. And my mother was so forceful in her understanding of all that. And we're talking about a housewife in the 1950s.
Right.
And she understood all that. And she was also, during the time that we were waiting for the war to get over, she was on the original board in Little Rock to plan for the integration of Central High School. And that started in the 40s. And she understood that it was necessary.
So this is during the time when the war was going on. Yes, Grandpa was gone.
Yes, and
she had this young boy.
Yes.
So she felt, she saw what was happening in America that day, that day and age, and she felt like she needed to be a part of that, to make movement and change happen.
Yes.
So if I reflect on, you know, maybe what's happening today in the world, and especially with this Me Too movement that's been a very powerful thing happening to us right now. What do you think that Granny would be saying about this Me Too movement?
She was innately, firstly, an independent woman. And so she would say, I think today, she would say, go for it, ladies. You know, there is really, I mean, the idea that women are not paid the same as men or whatever the other issues are and the Me Too right now, she would be all for it.
When Alan Rippon was a young teenager, her mother, Mimi Vickers, and stepfather moved her out onto a farm and away from her comfort zone. Today, Rippon loves to visit her mom on the farm, and in this conversation, the women talk about what the farm came to mean to the family and how it has ultimately brought them closer together.
Did you ever really see yourself on a farm, you know, when you were growing up?
I don't know if I had a real vision of myself in, you know, overalls, but...
So what made you and Gary, your second husband, choose this
beautiful
property?
Gary had grown up in Mississippi, out from Jackson, and he had some rural roots. His grandfather was a farmer in South Georgia, and I think that our two visions, if you would say, I mean, I really sort of took his lead in it. I probably protested and said, what, you're taking me to the country? But then,
yeah.
Well, the main thing was taking you to the country.
Well, that's another interview, but I mean, when I was thinking
when you're 14, that wasn't a real happy time.
When I was thinking about this interview, I was like, oh, having a farm was highly unfashionable when I was growing up.
Oh, you bet.
Like, you guys were ahead of the curve because that was not something you really, you know what I mean?
Gary was one of those people who had a larger-than-life view of things, really. I mean, he wanted to experience all kinds of things. And so we ended up with goats. And so what did we do with the goats? We milked the goats and we made goat cheese. I mean, we went to a farm to learn how to do it. And it wasn't for anybody other than us and our friends. I mean, our friends thought we were nuts, but...
Well, you made them try to eat the chocolate goat cheese truffles and they didn't politely put them back on their plate.
We thought that was the coolest recipe ever and they were sticking them under the chairs in the yard. Anyway, we had fun doing it.
I mean, Gary would be very interested in not just getting two, but four. I mean, he would, you know, just...
Oh.
order them out of the magazine and have them show, whatever, I don't know.
Well, and process, then we took on then sheep, the right, yeah. Sheep, and then, you know, chickens. Well, then the chickens started to outnumber the people and yeah. the dogs and the cats. And, I mean, didn't we look out one day yeah. and we said, how yeah. many chickens? 80. We've seen 80, and then, then one day he comes in with two baby pot-bellied pigs, one okay. under each arm. Well, they, of course, the cutest things you've ever seen. And he said, you know what? He said, these things are really smart. Yeah. And you can actually train them to live in your house. Well, you can imagine. My jaw dropped open. But he brought in, you know, he had the litter pan, the cat litter and all that. And I said, So we tried that little thing out for about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
We decided,
yeah.
no, that was not going to be the place for them. I still have those pigs, and they're just marvelous, and I can't
those,
wait.
Those are the original
those
pigs?
Those are the original pigs.
I did not know that.
Tweedledum
Will
and Tweedledee.
You talk about your ritual every night?
Oh, them? Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I love feeding them whatever, you know, if we have a leftover sweet potato skin or the tops off of strawberries, and they just look at me with such pleasure in their eyes. I've tried to give them the best home possible. I've let them be animals in their own right and not expected more of them than they wanted to give me. Maybe I've expected more of you than
you.
No,
okay.
I'm just kidding
okay.
you. But no, you have fulfilled every
thanks.
Everything that could be wonderful about having a daughter.
My earliest memory with you of you, me, and nature, and you took me on a nocturnal walk through the tree
marsh
Oatland Island, and to this day I can still remember being snuggled next to you, and I think you even wrapped a coat around me or something, and we were on the plank, walking the planks of mm-hmm. this sort of
in the marsh,
this dock, and the sound of the owl.
And what did it say?
Who cooks for you?
And then it would say, who cooks for you all?
That's right. That's right. To this day, that's one of my favorite memories of us. And it kind of like launched the boat of nature loving and appreciation of the outdoors. And not just appreciation, but just finding so much nourishment in it and with it. What's the pleasure this all gives you? Because it's so magical.
I think it's nurturing, for one mm-hmm. thing. But also, and I've written some things over the mm-hmm. years, and, you know, maybe I could share a little bit of that.
Yeah.
A little bit of that, too, and sort of, you know, I would say that there's a predictability in nature or a structure that one can count on. I know there's mathematical precision, the ratios, the Fibonacci numbers in the spiraling seeds of a pine cone or the head of a sunflower. It's that structure that helps me feel safe. In the natural world, there's no anarchy or struggle. Buds unfold into blooms. The seasons come and go. Animals live and die. It's the reminder of these natural cycles of life that I need. But as I've aged, I know it's possible to rekindle that kind of enthusiasm and passion. And over the course of some 30 years, I've come full circle. I'm all about finding joy wherever I can, in the simplest of things, in deep emotion and in human connection. I'm learning to trust as I eat this bread of life.
I love that. Oh, my gosh. Tears in my eyes. Thank you so much, Mom. I've loved
Thank
sharing this
you,
time
my
with
dear.
You.
This has been wonderful.
Our final conversation comes from mother and daughter duo Anise and Danielle Ritter. Anise had always wanted to be a mother, even from a young age. But as she tells Danielle, being a mother isn't always so easy. She also shares with her daughter some valuable advice she received from her own mother about what it's like raising children.
If you could hold on to one memory from your life forever, what would that be?
I think the memory that is the most important to me is when I had my children. So it was you and your sister. Those were the days that it was kind of the fulfillment of a dream for me to have children. When I was young, I always wanted to babysit. I always wanted to take care of younger kids. In fact, I just loved taking care of my baby dolls, but to actually have my own children. So those were the two most important moments of my life, when I gave birth to you and your sister.
Mm-hmm, so sweet. Is there anything that you've never told me but want to tell me now?
I think sometimes I neglect to let your sister and you know how sometimes I get lonely. Mm-hmm. I think people see me all the time as being the strong one in the family, the one everybody turns to. Your friends and Jay's friends always call me Mom.
Yes.
Sometimes it's nice, but sometimes it's like, I don't always want to be somebody's mother at my age now. I want to be nurtured sometimes. I want to be in that role of not necessarily the child, but
being taken care of.
Being taken care of a little bit without being dependent
right.
upon you or your sister. But sometimes it gets hard being the one that everybody turns to.
Are you proud of me?
Of course I am. I'm proud of both you and your sister. You know, I think about that sometimes. You know, my mother had to drop out of school when she was leaving. I think she finished sixth grade. And so she always wanted to get an education and never was able to do that. When my grandfather told her she was going to have to leave school so that her siblings could go, she said she cried for a week. She mm-hmm. loved school.
Right.
So just the fact that, you know, I was able to get an education, then, well, my siblings, my brother and my sister, you know, we all have a college education, something my mother always wanted. And then for you and your sister both to, you know, have finished college. But I'm very proud of both of you.
People used to say I was following in your footsteps.
Oh, that's right. That's right. By being a teacher. Yeah.
Not saying I, you know, left teaching because of that. But
right.
I just didn't get the fulfillment. Do you have a funny story about me growing up?
Mm.
Something that's funny. Because I know I'm funny.
Well, I remember being at my parents' house. I mean, you were upset about something and you were crying. And I remember Papa saying, don't cry now because you're at Papa's house, you know. And I remember going in the back and talking to my mother about you being upset about something. You had misbehaved, you or your sister had misbehaved, and I was talking to my mother about it, and I said, Mom, if that had been me or Billy or Anthony, you know, you would have taken the switch to us. And I remember her saying to me, she said, that's because I didn't know any better. I do it differently now. And I think about that when I look at Maya and Jadel. Complain about Maya and I. When you're a grandparent, you see things totally different.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of StoryCorps Athens. We hope you've enjoyed these conversations celebrating moms everywhere. StoryCorps Athens stories were recorded locally in the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Athens Clark County Library in the fall of 2018. StoryCorps is part of a national initiative to record and preserve the stories of everyday people. All of the interviews were produced locally by Morgan Fry. For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury.